Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Tuesday, 5th of January, second trading day of 2021. Boy, some really divergent developments if you look at what's going on in the US. Yesterday's sudden jerk lower in that session, very ugly session intraday, managed to recoup some of those losses into the close, but I think net net, not a really a pretty sight. And then contrast that with the ongoing ramp up in China. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But just wanted to point out on slide two, I mentioned yesterday some signs of momentum divergence that could be a concern for the bulls. You can see that on the stochastic indicator at the bottom there, but also I neglected to draw in what was a fairly well-defined as a classic sort of ascending wedge formation where we saw a failure of that. And so I guess locally we'd be focusing on the 21-day moving average, which is a bit below here and which we managed just to close above yesterday. Very similar setup in the S&P 500. I suppose the downside, Peter, is mostly linked to sudden concerns that we're going to see these two seats in Senate runoff races in Georgia going to the Democrats. There's split opinions on that. If on the one side, it's great for liquidity. It looks like we might get the $2,000 checks. There was even a specific Biden statement saying, hey, let's get these two seats in Georgia and we'll have $2,000 stimulus checks. But then there's the taxes and green agenda side of things, which I suppose is also a concern here. Or what's your take? Am I ever reading too much into just what might be noise?
Well, I think that yesterday's knee-jerk reaction twofold. It was the Georgia runoff indications that the Democrats could get those two seats, as you mentioned. And you're absolutely right. I think the initial thought process, and that was also what we talked about on our internal meeting in the team yesterday, was that it would be great for stimulus and that will, you know, lift the growth outlook. But you rightly point out that I think if the Democrats suddenly control the U.S. Congress, it definitely could lead to, higher wealth taxes, increased taxes on capital gains, and then you have the whole green agenda. I don't know how much of the green agenda, how big a hit that would be to the U.S. economy. And I know, of course, the gasoline is a big item for many households, and that could potentially be the angle that is as negative as well there. But I think so. That was one of the catalysts, and then the second one was that I think it just came to the realization of the market that this new mutation that I just read some analysis this morning that virologists experts say that this new mutation in the UK probably will be the dominant mutation going forward because it's more contagious, but it's a little bit less deadly, and that seems to be a better optimum long term for this virus. So, but it's just completely smashing the capacity levels at hospitals in the UK. And that's also why Boris Johnson yesterday, did another very severe third lockdown. And I think that has seen a negative impact, I think, on the market as well. I mean, I think the market is a bit spooked about this battle between the rollout of vaccines and a potential ramp up in new cases.
Yeah, and even the this very aggressive plan or hope for plan in the UK to roll out 14 million vaccinations by mid-February. So we're talking on the scale of 5 to 6 weeks. Would require 2 million vaccinations a week. And essentially you're having to have more or less complete lockdown, I assume, between now and then. It's an awful long waiting period. And then on the oil front, well, I know there's some OPEC action going on yesterday, and you were on Bloomberg TV this morning discussing that. But as a chart technician, that turnaround yesterday was really ugly. Was that also partly the COVID-19 news flow?
It was indeed, John, and we literally in half a day went from this vaccine optimism, which has driven the market now for nearly 2 months, to new pessimism because these prolonged lockdowns and the market starting to talk about the UK shutting down completely, which they then did, not supporting the sentiment. And then adding to that, the OPEC Plus meeting, which basically they were supposed to meet up yesterday virtually, obviously, to decide what to do with production in February. And having increased production here in January by 500,000 barrels, the market was starting to get a little bit too worried about whether they were going to add another 500,000 barrels next month, because just simply the global economic recovery is so uneven, strong in Asia, weak outside of Asia, and into such a market, it's very important what kind of signal value you're sending it. So the OPEC meeting, they left yesterday without an agreement. They're meeting again today. Russia wants to increase production. Saudi Arabia say, hold on, let's just stay at these levels for a bit longer. And that's really what the market is reacting to. But you're absolutely right. It's pretty ugly bar. I think the key there was probably the 50 level in WTI crude, which we almost kissed and then got rejected. And that also helped bring Brent crude back down with it. But we have to remember that it's been a speculative surge in across these commodities now for the past few months. Oil has been one of them. And part of this rally is obviously helped by investors who've never seen a barrel of crude oil. They're more interested in oil from a reflationary perspective, and they obviously could get a bit of a wake up call if we break lower. So I think for now, if looking at Brent again, 49 is probably a line in the sand there. So we're still a couple of bucks away from that, but interested to see what OPEC Plus decides later today.
Yeah, and we have some more thoughts on your commodities positioning slide later with the COT report. But two things here. Well, you talked about strength in Asia. We'll get to that in a second, but I just want to have to mention Bitcoin here with a merely almost $7,000 trading range in 2 days. We mentioned yesterday that these sort of super exponential advances, in other words, when the price action, even on a log chart, starts to go beyond trend, it can become quickly destabilizing. Well, quickly turned out to be a matter of minutes. I think even as I was compiling the podcast and sending it up, it started correcting a bit there, and it went all the way down to around $28,000 before rebounding to something like 33. So down 7, up 5, down 3, and now we're up almost 2 from where we were. It's a zany price action. So I put for some perspective, slide 4, no idea if this repeats, but you can see that circle the previous very large correction, which actually in a logarithmic chart in percentage terms shows you that at the daily close, it was actually a worse day than yesterday, despite more volatility this time around. That sort of correction in late November sort of signaled that even though it did post a moderate new high in ensuing days, the Bitcoin price consolidated for a good almost 4 weeks before marking its next advance. So I think the two-way price action just sets up a warning that we can't just see one-way price action forever, and it leads people to some distribution and changing hands in two-way price action for a while. That could be the situation here. I certainly don't have any news or thoughts on anything that I would call fundamentals. Although on the next slide, one of those fundamentals that might be driving interest in things like Bitcoin and gold and otherwise is the anticipation of inflation down the road. So what are we seeing here on this slide? Slide 5, you see it's a very long-term chart. Note that we're back into the 90s here. You have the nominal US 10-year yield in blue, which is currently around 92 basis points. And then you have the nominal current treasury inflation protected treasury yield, which is minus 111 basis points. Now, people are not buying those in anticipation of receiving minus 100 basis points in return. They are buying those in the anticipation that, or in hedging the risk that CPI inflation will rise, because the principal on those bonds is tied to the CPI. So if inflation does rise, they get some protection from that. But that difference is what is called the break even. And you see that the break even, which is displayed in green there, has now hit the 2% level for the first time. I can't tell on my chart here, but it's been the first time in a couple of years here. So anticipating basically pricing in that the CPI is ready to return to 2% plus down the road. Very interesting development, a key level to watch, that 2% level on the break even. Yeah.
I just wanted to jump in here when you talk about the yield and inflation or reflation hedges, because we put out a Saxo's a commodity sector basket yesterday, which you can find on analysis.saxo, where we tried to find 40 large cap stocks across energy, agricultural, chemical, and then metal and mining, to sort of give you an idea of where you can get broad exposure. And we've put in this portfolio basket into the Bloomberg, and we ran the performance going back in time, and it's quite interesting that the last time we had that reflation period that people are worried about now was basically from January 2016 to around mid 2018. That was where we really got the inflation pressures going. The Federal Reserve hiked its interest rate many times all the way into actually back in late into 2018, where inflation rates were already coming off a bit. And during that period, this 40 stock portfolio basket of commodity sector stocks actually outperformed the global equity market by almost 70 percentage points. So that's a pretty big outperformance. So I think there is a lot of interesting ways to hedge inflation risk and the commodity sector, while it's the physical commodities where you have to, of course, to deal with the rolling of futures. You could also look for companies in that sector and thereby you're also getting actually an implied leveraged bet because of the balance sheet that they're running.
And we put a tease on for this article on slide 9, just the latest commodity updates. Also, I added one where just basically commodities bowled out the gates to kick off 21. So you can just see a couple of teasers there, but you can find them on analysis.saxo.
Good stuff. All right. Now, we circling back to our comment earlier, this sort of difference between price developments at the start of the year here between at least the U.S. It's just a one day. We're only one day into the new year for trading in the U.S. But what's been a more persistent and aggressive trend, and that is the upside trend, especially in Chinese equities. Take us through your thoughts there on slide 3, Peter. Then I've got a couple thoughts on the currency as well.
Yeah, it's Chinese equities are really getting bit here. I'm a little bit bewildered whether how much of it is actually foreign interest or whether it's just domestically oriented speculation. But it's really there, as you say. You can see here on slide 3. I mean, we're pushing towards those highs back from 2015. So very interesting development here. It's obviously part of the reflation trade. We know emerging markets do very well. It is also a resource-dependent economy. But I've put in a small snippet here, and I apologize for it being so small. I just didn't want to chop off some of the charts here. I think that was a little bit more important. But the big worry about China, I think, is that the crackdown on the technology sector would be a pretty big headwind for earnings growth, because it's coming from the technology sector. That's one worry. But the other worry is, as you can see on the insert, that the net debt to EBITDA, which is basically the net debt, so the gross debt minus cash, divided by the operating income from the businesses in the CSI 300 index. That's a 7.5 times. So that's, I mean, if we had Althea on the podcast as our fixed income strategist, especially, she would say that this is a pretty high ratio. And that is, I think, the big concern for China, is that it's a super leveraged economy. It's a super leveraged private sector in terms of its publicly listed companies. So that's the worry. I do worry that we could see a significant correction in China when we get the overall correction in global stocks.
Yeah, and we've talked before about why the Chinese currency is going up, and we had an incredibly strong session for that currency yesterday. It's followed through a little bit today, but actually the onshore Chinese yuan or renminbi is back sort of within range and actually flat relative to yesterday. So I think that sends a louder signal than perhaps the CNH, but you can see that on slide 6, and you're seeing the CSI 300, which is a slightly different index than the one you showed, Peter, I believe anyway. No, it's the same one. Heading towards those highs since 2015, which would open up that 2007 high as the last mark there. China clearly trying to attract inbound investment. It's been doing so with supposedly having cleared up on the virus front, but as well by keeping a relatively tight monetary policy, which allows more attractive yields and taking a very different approach from previous cycles. So rather than just going all out on the stimulus front, it's enjoying the incredible stimulus that's been unleashed around the world to respond to COVID-19. A lot of that stimulus finding its way to China as the world's factory, and then able to hopefully, in this case, to deleverage some of that leverage that Peter is talking about, which I think is very much across many Chinese companies. I'm very curious as well, Peter, how this interacts with the incoming Biden administration and U.S. sort of ongoing U.S. attempts to delist Chinese stocks from U.S. exchanges over accounting rules on the one hand, and I guess over purported links to the Chinese military on the other hand.
Yeah, we had the news coming out of the holiday season or holiday period before New Year that the New York Stock Exchange would delist the big telecommunication companies from China, China Mobile, etc. And they all have very liquid listings in Hong Kong, so there was no really need for that. And it was basically dictated by the U.S. administration. And I sort of a little bit laughed this morning when I saw the Chinese securities regulator saying that this was a politically motivated move, because today with the New York Stock Exchange announced that they will not delist them anyway. But the whole point that it was a politically motivated move, I just laughed about that, because of course it's political. That's the whole idea about what's going on between the US and China right now. It has become political, and every single decision from now on will not be based on maybe in any step a rational decision necessarily. It's about, you know, getting your national interest in order, and maybe tease the counterpart, and so I would not be, I would expect more from this, and I think ultimately we'll have very, very few Chinese companies listed in the US going forward. They will be subjected to accounting regulation, etc., which the Chinese government will never allow, and as a result, I think a lot of Chinese companies will ultimately delist. And I think if you want Chinese exposure, get it through the Hong Kong Exchange, or if you're a client with Saxo, buy the A or the A shares directly in the mainland, or buy an ETF out of Hong Kong that gives you the exposure. Don't dwell too much on the US exchange listings, but that's just my personal view. And then you might ask, okay, what do I do then if I want to have exposure to NIO? Well, that's a very good question. I don't have a good answer. I just know that I think you should be cautious if you dwell with Chinese exposure on US exchanges. It's not worth the risk. Go for the Hong Kong and mainland Chinese listings.
All right. Interesting advice there. And we've talked a good deal about various bubble stocks and sectors that we're concerned are a bit bubbly. Tesla up, by the way, $24 yesterday, only about a percent, percent and a half ish from a $700 billion market cap. So still the infinity and beyond story pumping away there. But this company that actually crossed my radar a few days ago because of this purported solid state battery, which is the nirvana for battery driven cars, if that technology can be reached. I know Toyota's working on something. Very fascinated to see if that comes to light, because it really becomes an existential threat to Tesla if quadruple if it's competitive on all fronts. But long story short, QuantumScape, so some company that supposedly has some solid state technology. Is there anything there, Peter? Look at this stock on slide 7. What the heck's going on?
So what the heck is going on also with Tesla? I mean, we won't talk so much about Tesla. We won't talk about Tesla today. It's just unbelievable what's going on there. But we talked about it yesterday, so go find the podcast from yesterday. But
is that a promise to listeners not to talk about Tesla every day?
Yeah, but we might have to if they gobble up the entire stock market. Okay, so on slide 7, QuantumScape. It came out of a SPAC. So SPAC sort of came into prominence last year. It's basically a blank check company. So an empty shell where you put in a lot of money and you have a statement where you specify what type of assets you're looking for. So it's kind of sort of a reverse initial public offering. And you can see here on slide 7 that it was you typically listed at $10 per share, and that was where the price were. And then there was a lot of speculation in September, October. Nothing really happened with QuantumScape. But then in November 27th, you have the big pop, and the SPAC announced that they had taken over this company, and the name was changed to QuantumScape. They have acquired this technology, solid state battery technology, as you said, John, which is in theory superior to the lithium ion batteries. It cannot accidentally spark fire to the same degree as lithium iron, has better recharging capabilities and more lifetime as well. So it's, as you said, it's nirvana. But the problem has always been, how can you manufacture these things in a commercially effective and scalable way? And that's the problem. And QuantumScape claims that they have that technology to do that. But that caused the stock to ramp all the way to $130 per share just the day before Christmas, and giving this company without any revenue, any manufacturing skills. And as the Wall Street analyst said yesterday, there's not a single data point evidence for this technology on the actual road. Everything is just in a test laboratory. It hit 50, so that's 50 billion dollars in market value before Christmas, and since then it has plunged 60%, but it still sports a market value of $18 billion, which is more than most of the biggest auto suppliers in the US. So I think this just shouts out to the world that seriously, be careful about these bubble stocks. There's a lot of speculative fever going on everywhere, and I mean, look at the gap down, the gap down. I mean, it's you cannot even run risk management on these. So if you gamble in these stocks,
lottery tickets,
tickets. Do it with a small portion of your wealth. Don't bet the farm on this.
Yeah, good points there. And Ole, I left you hanging too long. Clearly, with this break-even inflation, I noticed there was a great chart. I'm not sure if you retweeted it. I think it was maybe Eleanor that retweeted it from. Julian Brigden noting this huge trend line that is broken in the in one of the big commodity indices, the Bloomberg Commodity Index, suggesting that that's a major technical development, which of course it is. But the market is pretty thoroughly positioned for this already. Wouldn't you argue from your slide or your chart? Sorry, on slide 8.
Absolutely, John, and that obviously raised just a little bit of a concern here as we kick off the year, because as you can see on slide 8, the speculative interest held by or speculative position held by large funds, money managers, speculators, hedge funds, whatever you call them, reached 2.5 million lots at the end of last month, so basically last Tuesday, and we can see on the insert there that there's not a single position that is now in a net short. There are long positions held across all three sectors. The difference this time compared to the two previous peaks we had in 2017 and 18 is that this time around, it's a broad-based rally. It's as much the agricultural space as it is the energy sector that is driving this this big accumulation of speculative long. So it obviously highlights the market is firm belief in higher prices, driven by fundamentals, driven by tightening supply, weaker dollar, reflation, and what have you. You know all the different factors, and it does obviously raise the question: what could go wrong? And that's probably where we should focus mostly, I think, over the next few weeks, because the market is really poised for further gains, and that's obviously when you need to be a little bit cautious. But I think the first step towards a continuation would be the Senate election today. If we do get a Democratic two Democratic candidates there, then obviously the reflation trade will stay alive, and then basically means that, as you mentioned earlier, you can move into inflation protected bonds, or you can look at commodities, and you'll be looking at the most liquid ones there and with the best fundamentals. And right now that is crude oil, maybe not from a fundamental perspective later in the year perhaps, but most certainly is gold and also some of the key crops which have been rallying strongly in recent weeks. So so basically, yeah, the market is poised for further gains, and that is potentially just in the short term a little bit of a concern if we see some of the drivers up until now start to fade.
All right, good stuff. Yes, and that takes us to the calendar. Of course, we do have those Senate runoff elections today. Who knows when the results are ready, especially if it's a super close vote, as was the case in Georgia for the actual presidential election. That's one of the reasons we're having a runoff, although it's actually about multiple candidates from one party. That was the issue. Supposedly the polls, which we all know not to trust too much these days, showing that the Democrats are starting to pull ahead. I wonder if Trump to a degree has shot himself in the foot with some of the maneuverings around all of this and his behavior post-election. I don't know. It's a question mark. Let's see what happens. The trouble might be that we don't get a result, a clear result, even tomorrow. But if we do, again, the interesting to see where the market reacts along the axis of risk appetite. Is this good or bad? You know, is the focus on green agenda / taxes, or is it more on the stimulus side that is, you know, liquidity with no end? Stimulus checks are going to be $2,000 after all, a weak dollar, et cetera, et cetera. So I think some combination of that is likely on a Democratic win. Other things to pull out, ISM manufacturing. Note that the employment index only poked above 50 on that one once in the recent cycle, if I'm not mistaken, and it certainly went below 50 in the last reading. So the U.S. economy is losing momentum, and everything that we're pricing is, of course, for a vaccine rollout and successful recovery post that. So just some reality checks are interesting there. I don't think the market reacts to these, but I like to look at these for input. And the prices paid could be interesting. It's up at 65 last time around and above that. And how are prices developing for manufacturing inputs? ISM services later this week on Thursday, FOMC minutes tomorrow night. We all know that the Fed is staying at zero and then the jobs data up on Friday. With that, I think we'll close out this rather long Saxo Market Call podcast. Thanks for joining today, and we'll be back tomorrow with another edition.